Night on the Banks.
Each fortnight along the banks of the River Raritan, folk from near and far gather as the round table is convened to discuss matters of concern which range from the heart of Queen's campus to the far corners of the globe. Now, as all is called to order, we give you the host of Night on the Banks, Stuart Narr.
Hello and welcome to the premiere of Night on the Banks. Anyone who has ever moved into an area that's new to them usually wants to learn the background and history of their new location. And this show, being one of the newest arrivals at the Queen's campus, is no exception. So to start things off, we're going to look back, back to an era that begins before Rutgers was a university, before the U.S. was a country, and as you'll soon hear, before Rutgers was Rutgers. With us to discuss the early history of the institution that went on to become the State University of New Jersey is the man who's most qualified to do so. Professor of History, University Historian, the Dean of Rutgers College, Dr. Richard McCormick. Professor McCormick, let's start at the very beginning. The year was 1766 when a charter was granted to Queen's College. Who is responsible for the founding of the school, and what were the circumstances that led up to that event?
Well, the story really began back in 1755 when what we might call a liberal faction within the Dutch Reformed Church decided that the time had come to provide a college that would essentially be designed to prepare candidates for the Dutch Reformed Ministry. At that time, young men who wanted to enter the ministry of the Dutch Reformed Church generally had to go back to Holland for their theological training. This was very expensive, it was very hazardous. So the idea was to establish an American college, primarily, but not exclusively, to provide a training ground for ministers for the Dutch Reformed Church. This effort engendered a good deal of controversy within the church, and in effect that controversy delayed the founding of the college until finally in 1766 Governor William Franklin of New Jersey was prevailed upon to grant a charter for what was to be called Queen's College. And the initiative then came essentially out of a concerned group within the Dutch Reformed Church.
Is that name Queen's, does it have any significance, or was it just chosen as like any other name, out of a hat or something?
No, I suppose you'd say this was a kind of political flattery. It was named Queen's College after the then Queen Charlotte in England. And by perhaps paying this kind of tribute to the Queen, it may somehow have eased the way in the granting of the charter. Similarly, of course, you had in New York, King's College.
What kind of town was New Brunswick at the time of the founding of the college? Was it, I know it was a major city at the time of the Revolution, but at that time in 1766, what kind of size and what kind of stature did New Brunswick have?
Well, of course, the whole scale of things was different. The total population of the colonies as of 1766 was under 3 million. New Brunswick was one of the half dozen largest towns in New Jersey at that time. It had about 150 houses, maybe 1,000 people. I know this seems very small, but again, in terms of the scale of that time, it was a bustling place. Its chief reason for being, of course, was that it was at the head of navigation of the Raritan River, and farmers from up the Raritan in Somerset County and Middlesex County could float their produce down the Raritan. And there were a number of important merchants in New Brunswick who would undertake to transship that goods on sloops to New York or Philadelphia or wherever. So it was basically a market town at the time of the American Revolution.
Okay, taking a look at the college itself, being one of the first schools in the area, one of the first colleges in the area, it doesn't seem that there would have been many examples for Queens to model itself after. Did this pose a problem for the founders of the school?
Not really. As perhaps we'll come to in a moment, the college was so small and so simple in its format that the options were extremely limited. We were, of course, the eighth college to be founded in the colonies, so that there had developed by 1766 some concept of what a college was in America. It was a concept very different, of course, from that of the great universities of Europe, but from the time of Harvard in 1636 on down through the other colleges, a kind of model had developed which essentially vested control over the institution in a board of trustees, which assigned very minimal governing powers to the faculty for understandable reasons, because the faculty usually consisted of a few very young men who had recently graduated from some college. And the curriculum tended to be extremely restricted, essentially focusing on Latin and Greek and a little mathematics and a little of what was called natural science or natural philosophy, and a minimum of history or literature.
Was there anything like we have today with electives and some required courses, but a big, wide choice? Did they have any choice in those early days?
Not only did they have no choice in those early days, at Rutgers College, and this didn't differ vastly from other colleges, there was virtually no choice of courses down until late in the 19th and even early in the 20th century. That is to say, as each student came in, not only was there a prescribed curriculum, but there was only one curriculum. So that every freshman student took precisely the same set of courses as every other freshman.
You alluded to thinking of discussing more what the college was like. After the founding of the college and following that founding, I don't imagine that, as the recent case of Livingston College, a campus was built right away and a quota system was set to allow students in. Where were the first classes for Rutgers held, and who attended them? I gather no women attended the school at that time.
Well, I hope that a good many of our listeners are sufficiently familiar with New Brunswick to know where Albany Street is. Perhaps you know where the Albany Street Bridge is, and that will clue you in as to where Albany Street is. On the corner of Albany and Nelson, there is a shoe repair establishment, the Lightning Shoe Repair. And it is in that building that Queens College held its first classes in 1771. The building at that time was a tavern, the sign of the Red Lion. And the college trustees acquired this building, which housed the students in the college. It also housed the students in the preparatory school, or grammar school as it was then called, and it also housed the faculty, which consisted of two young men. You have to understand, again, that it was an extremely, incredibly small operation. As of 1775, for example, when the college had been in existence for 4 years, there were perhaps a total of 20 students in all of the four classes of the college. In 1774, when the college held its first commencement, there was one graduate.
Well, that leaves a lot of room for, I guess, some.
There was room
numbers.
For growth. Yeah, there was room for growth.
All right, you explained before that the college was a product of the Dutch Reformed Church, and I guess by that I could take that to mean that there was basically no autonomy in the school itself, that the church did run the school?
No, that's not true. Although, as I said, it was started by people, most of whom were associated with the Dutch Reformed Church, it was not founded by the church. Indeed, at the time it was founded, there was no real organization of the church. Moreover, at no point was there any requirement that students must be member of any denomination, nor was there any requirement that students must take any course of religious studies. So that it was, from the beginning, accessible to students of any denomination, and it did not include in its curriculum any requirement for religious instruction.
Oh, okay. Then looking at that as more of a freer system than I had originally thought of.
Right.
You talked about before the basic courses that were offered at the time. What about degrees and majors? How does that compare?
No. The whole business of majors doesn't appear until the 20th century. As I say, every student who went through the college took exactly the same courses.
So there was one degree you
there
went
was
through and you got an
A-B degree, and that was it. And there was no flexibility whatsoever in the curriculum.
Okay, let's move into, you've already mentioned 1775.
And again, I would just like to say there was to be no real flexibility in the curriculum for a long, long time. This kind of fixed menu, if you will, prevailed well down into and indeed past the middle of the 19th century.
Oh, so then it had nothing to do with the background of the school, it was just the situation at the time.
And other schools adhered to essentially the same kind of so-called classical curriculum, the heavy emphasis, 4 years of Latin, 4 years of Greek, natural philosophy, moral philosophy, and in some instances a little bit in the way of what we would recognize today perhaps as history and geography and literature.
During this early period of the school, you already said that although the plans for the school were begun much earlier, the school itself didn't receive the charter until 1766. Were there any other particular problems that the people founding the school faced as they tried to begin Queen's College?
Well, they faced the same problem, I suppose, that we face today and have always faced, namely money. Because there was relatively little interest in those days in higher education, because, to put it bluntly, there was relatively little market or demand for higher education. All of these colleges struggled desperately to obtain the necessary resources to conduct their operations, even though the operations themselves were very small. And one of the factors, for example, that both helped to get the college established and helped to establish it in New Brunswick, the trustees offered to place the school in one or another New Jersey communities, depending upon which one would offer the most money. And essentially it boiled down to a competition between Hackensack, which is in Bergen County, and New Brunswick. And the trustees held a meeting in 1771, and they received bids from Hackensack, bids from New Brunswick. We don't know precisely what New Brunswick offered, but evidently it was a little better than Hackensack offered, and so the college was able to get started here.
It's nice to know we were founded by the highest bidder. All right, despite these money problems that you've already mentioned, and I guess any problems that you'd faced when you tried to found a college, by the 1770s, there was a fledgling institution underway here in New Brunswick. But while Queens was still in that infancy period, another historic event was beginning that was to drastically alter the future of the college and, of course, our whole history, and that was the American Revolution. How was Queens affected by that revolution?
Well, it was affected very, very drastically. By 1776, there were, as I say, something of the order of 20 students in the college. There were two tutors that constituted the faculty of the college. These were both very young men who had graduated in 1770 from Princeton, Frederick Frelinghuysen and John Taylor. So that what you want to conceive of is this former tavern down on Albany Street, inhabited by maybe 20 college students and these two young men who constituted the faculty. And they were going along. This was not an extraordinary situation compared to the start of other American colleges. But then, suddenly in June of 1776, came the word that a powerful British fleet and British army under the Howe brothers was arriving in New York, and that immediately created great concern. And what happened actually was that as soon as they heard that the Howes were arriving, the students collectively marched off to join in repelling the advance of the British. And for at least 3 months in 1776, the college ceased while the students went off to fight. Well, then in October, October of 76, classes resumed. But then around the 1st of December of 1776, following Washington's retreat across New Jersey, New Brunswick was occupied by the main force of the British Army. They just took over the whole town, several thousand British troops. It was the principal British headquarters in New Jersey from December of 1776 through to June of 1776. And of course, the college was, the students were very patriotic, and there was no place for them in New Brunswick, so they had to leave.
Where did they go?
Well, after a few months, one of the tutors, John Taylor, assembled about a dozen students, perhaps, out in the wilds of Somerset County at a place called North Branch. And in one way or another, this dozen or so students managed to receive some tutelage from Taylor and from others who appeared from time to time. And the college was sustained, but very, very precariously. And then after a year or so at North Branch, they moved back closer to New Brunswick to Millstone, which is just about 5 or 6 miles west of here. And they didn't come back into New Brunswick until 1784, when the war was completely over. Presumably, they didn't return until 1784 because the town had been very badly damaged by the British occupation and by other activities during the course of the war.
Okay, what about after the war? I really have no idea whether there was anything like a GI Bill or anything at that time. As we'll talk about maybe in a later show, how World War II affected the college, but what changes took place here after the Revolutionary War?
Well, even before we get into that, the war affected the college not only in terms of disruption, but the war did involve the students and the faculty and the president in very significant ways. The acting president at that time was Jacob Rutzen Hardenberg, who was named Hardenberg Hall after him. Extraordinary man. As I say, he functioned in these years as acting president, but he was also very active in the political life of the state in the period of the Revolution. He was a member of the Provincial Congress and of the state legislature, and later on of the convention that ratified the Constitution in New Jersey. John Taylor, one of the two tutors, became a colonel in the militia, fought at the Battle of Trenton and the Battle of Springfield and the Battle of Monmouth. So you sort of have the picture of John Taylor teaching class for a couple of weeks and then grabbing his gun and going off and fighting in a battle and coming back. The other tutor, Frederick Frelinghuysen, was also very active as an officer in the militia, as a member of the legislature, as attorney general of the state. Among the early graduates, for example, in the class of 1776 was Simeon DeWitt, after whom the geography house, DeWitt Building, is named. He became very quickly, utilizing the mathematical knowledge he had acquired at Rutgers, Washington's geographer general. That is to say, he was in charge of making all of the maps for Washington. And about half of the early graduates participated in military service, and a number of them in prominent political positions as well. James Skuerman, for example, of the class of 1775, after serving in the militia, became a member of the Continental Congress, later was elected to the first Federal Congress, and after that to the United States Senate. So although we're talking about a very, very small number of students and of graduates, it's quite extraordinary how many of them quickly assumed positions of political and military prominence, which suggests, among other things, a point that I think I want to make, that not all of them became ministers. As a matter of fact, among the early graduates during the first 20 or 30 years, only about a quarter of them actually became ministers. The rest became lawyers and businessmen and farmers and so on.
It's a very distinguished sounding group.
Yeah.
What about afterward? Did these men come back to the university? I should say the university, the college, after the war? Did they return here? Did they pick up the pieces?
You mentioned the question of returning GIs. We had a member of the class of 1780 by the name of Jeremiah Smith, who as a young man, a boy, if you will, actually fought in the Battle of Bennington. And after that military participation, came down here, entered college as a GI, if you will, and graduated in 1780, went back to his native state of New Hampshire, where he became governor of the state and later Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of New Hampshire. So there was a lot of quality in this group. I could mention many, many others.
Okay, we've gotten through the very early history of the college, right, through the Revolutionary War, but from the early days of the Red Lion Inn and up to the time we're talking about now, various places have served as a shelter for Queens, but no permanent home had yet been found. However, I think it was about a decade into the 19th century a site was chosen for, and construction was begun on the building that I suppose today is considered, at least by most students that I know here, to be the symbol of Rutgers College, and that's Old Queens. I mean the one on Somerset Street rather than the others that's also frequented very much around here. How did the decision finally, well, how was the decision finally reached to build that home?
Well, in a sense, every time I walk past that building, I have the sense of looking at a miracle. Let me explain. In 1795, it was necessary for the college to suspend operations. There just wasn't any money, even to pay the tutors the measly £100 a year that they were paid in those days to serve as the faculty of the college. So in 1795 they closed up, and for 12 years there were no classes. And one might have thought that after such a long period of time people would have given up hope. But there were a few men on the board of trustees of the institution who never gave up the hope of somehow or other reviving Queens College. And in 1807, led by Andrew Kirkpatrick, Kirkpatrick Chapel was given by his wife later on, not only do they decide to revive the college, but they decided to do it in an extraordinarily ambitious way by building what was then, of course, an enormous building, which we know today as Queen's Building. And they sent agents out throughout New Jersey and New York, sort of begging for money. About the largest gift they got from anybody was $5. And while the money was still being hopefully raised, they hired an architect, John McComb, a very distinguished architect, appointed a building committee, and started to build Old Queens. Well, they didn't come close to raising the kind of money they needed, and so then they tried holding lotteries. In those days, the state would permit charitable and educational organizations to conduct lotteries for the purpose of raising money. Well, for complicated reasons that I haven't the time to explain, the lotteries didn't produce the money. But nevertheless, in spite of the fact that when they finished the building it was far from paid for, they made this tremendous commitment and built that splendid building. And the college reopened in this new building in 1809.
In 10 seconds, can you give me one reason why, while many colleges failed at the beginning, Queens made it?
You'd have to say, time and time again, it was essentially the dedication and commitment of a few individuals. In the early days, particularly individuals on the Board of Trustees who, despite adversity and discouragement, continued to believe in the importance of providing for higher education, and were willing to make extraordinary efforts and sacrifices to sustain the college or revive the college as the case might be.
And on that positive note, I'm really sorry to have to call a halt to this discussion, but our time for this week is up. And just like any good book, though, we might put the story down for now, but I'll look forward to picking it up in the not-too-distant future. We've been talking with Dr. Richard McCormick, the university historian and dean of Rutgers College, about the early history of the university during the days of Queens College. And thank you, Professor McCormick, for making this our first show such a special one. And please come back again, often.
Be delighted.
Tune in 2 weeks from now at the same time as Night on the Banks reconvenes the roundtable for more interview, discussion, and debate of the issues that shape Rutgers and the world. Until next time, this is Stuart Knorr bidding you farewell from the banks of the old Raritan.